Welcome to a very special edition of Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Howard A. Burris, MD, also known as Skip, who is the President of Clinical Operations and Chief Medical Officer of Sarah Cannon Research Institute, as well as an Associate of Tennessee Oncology. Not only is he a 2014 Giant of Cancer Care and Drug Development, but Dr. Burris is also the elected President of ASCO for 2019 to 2020. He has led a number of research endeavors and has been part of the development of several agents now available for breast cancer treatment, such as adotrastuzumab emtansine, everolimus, and gemcitabine. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Burris spent time discussing how he wound up in the oncology space, his passion for getting to know and helping his patients, and some of his proudest moments throughout his monumental career, which includes his time as president of ASCO.
Dr. Burris, thank you so much for joining us today on Enclave On Air. I wanted to first just start off with learning some of your background and how you got into the field of oncology. What led you to specialize in this field and specifically going down the path of breast cancer?
My interest in oncology came about almost in a circuitous manner. I was very much interested in being a physician, largely because I wanted to do something meaningful that would help other people. I know some people are attracted, some physicians were attracted to the field from the science, and that certainly has been intriguing. But mine has been much more around taking care of patients, much more about getting to know patients, and that's been my passion. As I was going through training, frankly, I thought I would want to do something that was a little more dramatic, such as some of the high specialty surgeries. And I had a sentinel moment that I talk about where when rounding on the cardiovascular service after patients had received bypass surgery, talking to a patient and having the attending ask me what I was doing as they moved on. And he looked at me and he said, "Burris, he's fixed. Let's go." And I think there is that mentality, which is great. Those patients revere those physicians and truly see them as saving their lives. But I wanted and realized I liked more the longitudinal experience, getting to know the patients. So that being said, as I kind of wandered through rotations as a student and as a resident, it became clear to me that I gravitated toward the cancer patients and actually the cancer physicians. The cancer physicians, the oncologists loved what they were doing, and that patient group was so grateful for what was being done for them. And it was really those two aspects that got me to look deeper into oncology and end up choosing that to be my career.
That's great. Is there anything, I like what you said towards the end of that, you were really gravitated towards it, towards these patients. Was there anything that anybody kind of said to you in those early days or a specific experience that you had with a patient?
Well, there was a number of situations, but, you know, I think one in those early days was the simple fact that you were trying to help patients and their families at a time in their life where death was a real possibility, and yet their continual thanking us for what we were doing and being so appreciative. And I think the other part of that is, you know, the aspect of physicians are either comfortable or not comfortable with taking care of patients at that stage of their life. And I think that's a place where you need to be beyond nice. You need to be kind. You've really got to take some time and make that as good an experience as it can be for the patients and the family. I had many young patients back in the late 80s where we certainly nowadays would have better therapies for them. And when you saw some of these individuals losing their lives in their 20s, it really gave you the passion that we needed to do better on what should be a disease that was treatable. And of course, 30 years later, we do know that there are great advances and many of these patients do quite well.
I have to ask you, how did the nickname Skip actually come about for you?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not as exciting, and I didn't have a cool personal moment that led to somebody calling me Skip. I was born in the late 50s at a time when there were many Howards, Harolds, Hughes, and it was common to be a second, third, or fourth. So Howard Sr. was down the street, and Howard Jr., my father, was in the house. And so my mom tells the story that from day one, I was Skip. And I always thought that when I went to college, I would become Howard, or when I got out of med school and became a doctor, I would become Howard. And yet I, for whatever reason, remained a Skip. I think that sort of fit my personality a bit more. It's ironic that one of my sons, when he got to college and was doing an internship in town, came home one night and said, "Dad, you go by Skip at work. That seems so unprofessional." And even my children thought that when I walked into the hospital, I flipped to become Howard. But it's just a childhood nickname. It's never changed. And I'm likely not to have it change now that I'm almost 60.
I love it. Thank you for sharing that. Going back to kind of your day-to-day practice and how you interact with your patients, what would you say is kind of the motto that you live by in your daily practice?
You know, I think that is one of trying to put the patient to be the focus. And we talk about patient-centered research, and we talk about those factors. And, you know, we almost get to be a little bit of a cliche when we talk about that sort of approach. But there's a little sign that hangs by my clinic door that reads, "Everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about. Be kind always." And I talk about this because I think it's easy in the busyness to forget that that person in front of you has got circumstances beyond their cancer that you're not aware of. And I think that being willing to be part of that patient's life is just something that I've always welcomed and not resisted. So I think my motto very much is along that line of being kind to my colleagues, being kind to the patients that I'm caring for, and realize that they really are in a battle that I don't know all that's going on. I can help them with the cancer part, and then I can be a listening ear and a kind thought and conversation for them when they come to visit.
Has there ever been like a patient in particular? Obviously, you've had quite a number of them over the years, but is there any one patient or two in particular that really kind of completely changed like your way of thinking or changed your practice or just kind of overall had a lasting impact on you?
There's a few patients that stand out. One patient very, very early in my career when I was finishing fellowship who was a young mom with breast cancer who her simple goal was to see her young son get to kindergarten, first grade type years and teach them to read. And it was just such a sentinel moment to hear somebody who knew that they wouldn't be there. They weren't reaching for something that was unreasonable. They knew they were in a difficult situation. And for her, it was that moment of just, can I get through that? And can I teach my son to read? And hopefully he'll have memories of his mom reading to him someday. And that was so emotional, but yet also so impactful when we talk about the fact that, you know, patients need to have a goal, and sometimes it's an anniversary, sometimes it's a high school graduation or a wedding. But I realize that that is something that is important and something to talk about with patients as you care for them.
What would you define as your proudest moment so far in your career?
Having two sons that are 32 and 27, you know, when I think back about great memories, you know, your children continue to be the ones that you're most proud of. And big achievements, small achievements, those are the things that always bring a smile to my face. So I feel I need to mention that because that's clearly my proudest moment. On the professional side, you know, I think, frankly, being elected ASCO president, ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncology, really is the voice of oncology professionals. There's a number of great oncology societies that do a variety of things. But ASCO is such an institution. We gather together for the annual meeting, 40,000 plus people, and it's a place to reconnect with colleagues and to hear about the greatest advances. But as you become involved with ASPO as a member, the things that go on through the year, interactions on committees and task forces, it's clear that ASCO is the voice of oncology for the vast majority of oncology professionals. So getting elected ASCO president is something where you're really among a very select group. It's a peer recognition. You know, you have to be voted in by your colleagues. And it's really something that I think when people look at it in terms of the being an achievement for oncology that isn't tied to something specific scientifically or clinically, but is actually something that's tied to leadership, you know, that was has really given me a great deal of pride.
And I'd really like to expand further with ASCO. So kind of just going off of that more, like, what has it really been like for you to serve as ASCO's president, and what have you learned so far in this experience? What kind of changes maybe have you made or trying to make, and any kind of new initiatives with the organization that you'd like to share?
Yeah, great question. I think I sense that it was this way, but the reality is that for every opinion, there's an equally and often opposite opinion. I have just received so many emails, text, and had conversations with our colleagues where, just to give you examples, you know, some of our colleagues think the meeting's too academic, some think it's not academic enough, some think it's too focused on the academic physicians, some think it's too focused on the community physicians. And I think that's reminiscent of just what goes on in our country today, politically and across a variety of issues. The country is fairly divided. I think the oncology community has very different opinions, and what I'm wrestling with a bit is, I think maybe if you look at the spectrum of 100% of the people, that middle 80% is fairly aligned, and you can't get distracted by the 5% at either end that might just be more vocal, and yet they don't really represent those other endpoints. So it does take a minute to listen. It does take a minute to really think through what's best for the society and, frankly, try to keep things sort of centered. I also would say that we're at an interesting time with the legislature, with Congress on a variety of issues. The cost of health care continues to be a huge story, and how best to handle that remains a challenge. I will give credit to Congress and the administration today. They really do seem to want to listen to oncology professionals. They really want to hear from doctors and nurses as to what might be potential solutions that they're seeing out there in the field, and not necessarily being driven by what the insurers or what pharma thinks as we handle this problem. But it's been exciting to be involved. You're in a number of meetings with very, very smart people, and you're getting to weigh in on some decisions that are quite impactful. So it has been a great opportunity, and I've enjoyed it.
Looking back at this year's, obviously, the 2019 meeting, and this is a little bit of a broad question, but are there any, you know, maybe just a couple of highlights from this year's conference that you'd like to share?
Yes, I think compared to other years, there were some different approaches that came out in the discussions that I think should be highlighted. We, of course, had advances with drugs making a difference in terms of survival and patients benefiting, some more targeted therapies that had an impact on very specific mutations that some patients possessed with their cancer. But I thought three other areas. One, Atul Gawande's speech and Edward Ong's talk at the beginning, where they, in the presidential session, talked about, you know, the patient, talked about the experience with the patient receiving treatment, and then Dr. Gawande talking about really the importance of the social history and understanding what the patient's goals are. That resonated with me, and he has written a famous book about death and dying, and getting to that point that we as oncology professionals need to have that conversation, I think, was very key. I think another point that came up in the abstract session during the plenary was access to care. It was a simple look at patients being offered access to health care coverage by being part of the ACA, otherwise known as Obamacare, and that, in fact, having that type of insurance coverage led to improved access, improved staging, workup, and better survival in a group of women with cancer. So that was certainly an impressive result. So great to see that on the stage and talked about. And then another presentation that came up was the use of real-world data around looking at subgroups of patients. And I think there are small groups of patients where clinical trials can take quite a long time to get accrued. And if we can use real-world data to, in fact, make a decision, that certainly will advance the field more quickly. The example I refer to is approving one of the new CDK4 and 6 inhibitors for the treatment of male breast cancer. Breast cancer is a real problem, but just super small percentage compared to women. And so once these drugs have been approved for women with breast cancer, it was only natural that we would know out in the real world that men would receive the drugs. And that data showed they do just as well as the women, and we didn't need a clinical trial to have that label expansion. So just a nice step forward for how we might use data to help patients.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Those are some great highlights. Obviously, there's been, beyond the annual meeting, there's been a ton of research that's been presented this year. Throughout your career, what would you say is some research that you have been a part of that have had significant impacts on clinical practice, and what was it like to be part of those research?
That's something that I was fortunate, better to be lucky than good, in terms of early in my training. When in San Antonio, one of my early attendings and initial mentors was Dr. Daniel Von Hoff. And Dr. Von Hoff is famous in the world of drug development. Dr. Von Hoff received the Karnofsky Award, along with a number of other awards, for his work in drug development. And very early on, he got me hooked on the excitement of bringing new therapies to patients. So my research throughout my career has been focused largely on these first-in-human studies. A few aspects to that. One is the patient participation. So they truly are volunteers. They're entering into these trials knowing that often it's more likely they're going to help others by participating than helping themselves. But also, when you see some of these home runs and you see a patient that thought their options were exhausted and yet they have had a great response and do well for years, it really, really stokes the passion for drug development. So through the years, very, very fortunate. Some of my earliest phase one drugs were actually the taxanes, paclitaxel and docetaxel, that went on to be wildly successful in treating breast and ovarian cancer. Dr. Von Hoff and I were fortunate to be involved early on in the work of gemcitabine. Gemcitabine, the first drug approved for pancreatic cancer. The combinations of it and newer therapies have certainly surpassed gemcitabine by itself, but that was something in such a difficult disease that still I get some credit for. It was really the patients and a number of my colleagues, but that was a proud moment to have that drug approved for those patients and still gets talked about as a landmark study. And then if we fast forward to the last 10 years or so, the first antibody drug conjugate for breast cancer, T-DM1, that has grown up now, adotrastuzumab emtansine, we call it T-DM1. It is actually been moved now into even the neoadjuvant setting. So we're talking about actually likely curing women with breast cancer by this targeted therapy. And then I've had the good fortune now to really been involved in much of the work going on in the immunotherapy field. Our institution, Sarah Cannon, has been front and center in both the checkpoint inhibitors as well as these newer CAR therapies. We have done what we needed to do to have the infrastructure to be able to deliver those therapies to our patients. And it's exciting to see the field of cancer come back to that one patient at a time, individualized approach with these sorts of cellular therapies.
Great, thank you. And going back to kind of those earlier days of research, did you have any mentors along the way that kind of really guided you to where you are today?
I mentioned Dr. Von Hoff. I mean, Dan was fantastic in terms of pushing me forward. I think that's a role model for a mentor, making sure that they are pushing you to the stage, pushing you to the front of the publication, putting you to the principal investigator position. And I think, you know, that's one key aspect of being a mentor that's very, very key to being successful. So that's something that's so important. I also had the good fortune to have a chief of medicine, Dr. John Carpenter, when I was going through training, who I still think back about. It wasn't a phrase at the time in the 80s, emotional intelligence, but Dr. Carpenter probably had more emotional intelligence than anybody that I had met, and certainly not sure I've met anybody since that time that is optimistic, self-aware, and so in control of their emotions. No matter what was going on, he was unflappable. He stayed centered, no matter what mistake you thought you'd made or what stupid answer you'd given to a question. Dr. Carpenter was always able to lift you up and educate you in that way. And I think in the busyness of the world and with all the things that are going on, you know, having some folks to think about and really look at how they might do things, I think is really, really important.
I'm going to, of course, bring up our Enclave Giants of Cancer Care program. And back in 2014, you were named our Giant of Cancer Care and Drug Development. What does having that type of recognition mean to you, especially in a program that the award is, you know, you've been nominated by your peers?
Yes, that Giant of Cancer Care nomination selection was important to me, and I was surprised by it. As you say, peer recognition is the best. For your colleagues to select you among other colleagues is so impactful. And it was a bit ironic. I remember receiving the award that I had been nominated not too long after I had flipped through the original first class, the 2013 class of Giants of Cancer Care, and thought, wow, is it prideful to say I'd love to be in this book someday? And I was looking at some of that initial class and close friends and colleagues of mine, individuals like Tom Lynch, that were in that initial group, and I was actually hoping that I would have the honor bestowed on me someday. So it was important. It was something that you know, I am proud of. And again, there's a lot of great physicians out there. A number of my colleagues have made advances in the field far more impactful than the ones that I've contributed to. So again, being one of the Giants of Cancer Care for that selection was something that I'll forever be grateful to have received.
Well, we're very grateful to have you in the program as well, so thank you. And then just kind of in closing now, what are some other areas in oncology that you would really like to see flourish in the next few years? And also kind of a twofold question, but looking upon yourself, what's next for you in your career?
Great questions. You know, I think a little easier to say what do we need to do to see oncology continue to flourish. I have been advocating for and talking about the need for us to continue to look at the personalized medicine, precision medicine aspect of cancer care, trying to encourage our Sarah Canada physicians and colleagues and my friends and other physicians across the country to really think about the opportunity to have molecular profiling performed on their relapsed, recurrent, and metastatic patients. I think there's a sense that those sorts of tests are not always going to be directly applicable to the next therapy that the patient receives, and that is going to be true in some cases. But it's building the database for us to understand why some therapies work, why some therapies don't work, and what are the features that might be most important in designing new drugs. Also, those molecular profiles show us what we've always known. No two patients are alike. We have known that for years. We have known and I've heard the phrase biology is destiny so many times, but really understanding tumor biology and really beginning to understand what's causing a cancer to grow and mutate, those types of molecular profiles are so important. And I think they are going to help greatly with even understanding which patients are likely to benefit most from the new immunotherapies and the cellular therapy approaches. So I do want to see that flourish. We're seeing the growth of blood-based testing. We're participating in even blood-based testing to try to detect cancer earlier. So all those pieces of really understanding the building blocks of cancer, the DNA, the RNA, and those molecular profiles, that's really where we need to see the field flourish, and I think that's going to lead to the greatest advances. If I think about myself, what's next for me? Our CEO, Deanna Smith, and I have been talking about Sarah Cannon and the growth of the institution, and I think we know that it's important that this next generation is fully developed. So as ESCO president and over these next few years, I see much of my energy turning really toward making sure that the next generation is prepared and fully informed to take over the responsibilities of our institution, and actually pushing many of my Sarah Cannon colleagues to be heavily involved in national societies like ASCO. I think those are going to be important things, and to teach and to give on to the next group and to mentor them is probably the greatest contribution I can make over the next few years.
And Dr. Burris, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate all of your insight this morning. Is there anything else that I did not ask you, but you really would like to share with the audience?
You know, I will just like to tell one quick story about two different patients that impacted my career in different ways. I mentioned the young woman who simply wanted to be around a teacher, son to read. But I've written some papers and articles about a patient, Sylvia, who was one of the early women to take trastuzumab and benefit from it. She was full of life, and she was one of those role models for being a grateful, caring soul. And we often talked about that Sylvia took care of us. We didn't take care of her. She came into that clinic, and she lifted up other patients, and she lifted up other physicians. And, you know, to take a patient like that, embrace them, and, you know, let them be all they could be in our clinic, the impact remains today. And then I want to mention another patient, Gigi, who was one of the very first women to take T-DM1, to take the antibody drug conjugate. And she had lost her husband. She decided to participate in the clinical trial only with great urging and solely to help others. Her daughters were single, not yet married, and she was just in a place where she was ready to go join her husband. And participating in the trial led to an amazing result for her. She now today has the two daughters are married, and she has five grandchildren, and her life is completely different 10 years later. Went to her 65th birthday party recently, and, you know, to have a patient in the clinic that stands out as somebody who participated in the trial, had a great benefit, and saw something happen in their lives that they didn't expect, I think that also is a great role model for our younger physicians and for other patients, and to just see the impact that can be made with the new therapies we have today. So thank you for letting me tell those two stories, those two women participating in trials, benefiting, and then sharing their success with others to make an even bigger impact. That's been a great thing at Sarah Cannon, and something that's certainly been impactful for me.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing those. And I think that's also a good example, too, of you know, really pushing clinical trial enrollment. And, you know, I know some patients might be a little bit hesitant to go on a trial, but this is kind of an example of what can happen.
Absolutely. You know, we almost take for granted the abundance of new therapies. 8 new drugs approved by the FDA in 1998. And then in 2018, 20 years later, 48 new drugs or indications in oncology. And so, yet patients are still passing away from this dreadful disease. There's still so much room for improvement. And, you know, every one of those therapies only came to the market through the results of clinical trials. And these patients are volunteering, and I think we as physicians and nurses and the administrators helping to run these programs, we need to really keep clinical trials front and center.
Well, thank you, Dr. Burris. Thank you again. Really appreciate it.
And so appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Oh, no, the pleasure's mine. Thank you so much.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews with top KOLs in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.